All right, good morning, everyone. For those who don't know you, I'm Dan Bernard in the Department of Pharmacology. We like to tell our trainees here at McGill the importance of being prepared, so don't learn from what I'm about to do because I'm totally unprepared to give the introduction of our first speaker. I say that because Aaliyah kindly sent me the bio sketch, which then I lost. I thought Dr. Seminaro was going to be presenting later in the afternoon, so I'd have plenty of time to think about what I wanted to say, and then I came maybe 10 minutes ago and found out that she was the first speaker. So learn from my mistakes. I'll wing it because Stephanie told me it's better just to focus on her personal rather than professional attributes. I can tell you that, like me, she's a native New Yorker. So if she becomes nervous, we might hear that accent come out. But in all seriousness, after growing up in New York, Stephanie moved north. She went to a town that most New Yorkers don't like because of sports reasons, called Boston. Actually, I guess Montrealers don't really care for Boston either, but for a different sport. She earned her bachelor's and medical degrees both at Harvard, and she apparently likes it there because she's stayed ever since. She's an associate professor of medicine in Harvard Medical School at the Massachusetts General Hospital, a member of the world-famous reproductive endocrine unit there. She's been, in addition to being a practicing clinical endocrinologist, she's a very prominent and active scientist. She'll be telling us about some of her important work today. She's made really seminal contributions to our understanding of the central control of reproduction, and our understanding of the genetics of idiopathic hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. Don't try to say that three times fast. Among her many important discoveries, I think probably ranking toward the top of the list, was some work that she led in 2003 that led to a New England Journal of Medicine article describing the role of kisspeptins in the control of human and mouse puberty. And those observations have led to really a revolution in our understanding of the neuroendocrine control of reproduction. Over the last 10 years, work by Stephanie and others in the field have really advanced our understanding of things like puberty, how GnRH pulsatility is controlled, and how steroid negative and positive feedback are regulated. So we're really happy that she accepted our invitation to come today. I'm sure you want to hear more from her than from me. And so today she's going to talk about the hypothalamic control of reproduction, a kiss to remember. So Stephanie, welcome.
My New York accent definitely comes out. I had to disguise it for many years. I was telling Dan that I did speech and debate in high school, and I did radio work in college. And so, you know, you had to keep the accent under wraps. But when I get flustered, ask my family. It very much comes out. But I am half Canadian. I am married to a Canadian. So I have roots. In this wonderful country. My husband was raised in Ottawa, and my mother's a biochemist, and my mother-in-law's a biochemist, and my father-in-law's a surgeon here. So my husband's family has a strong tradition in science and medicine. So I can't tell you what a pleasure it has been to be here. I so appreciate the invitation from Dan, and how warm and wonderful yesterday was, having the luxury of time to meet with so many of you. I regret that I didn't get to meet as many. Oops. Trainees yesterday, and I hope that I get to meet some more over the course of today because that's so important during these kinds of visits. But thank you so much for letting me spend some time with you. And I have three goals for today's talk. There's a lot to fit in. So the first, because I'm an above-the-shoulders person in terms of what I study. So my first goal is to do sort of a survey review of some of the key genes that we believe are important in hypothalamic control of GnRH modulation in the human. And with that as context, I'll then try to set the stage for some important genotype-phenotype correlations in both human and mouse models, because that's what our laboratory does. We work a lot in the human, but also in the mouse, and we try to take some key concepts that we see in both models and drill down on them. So I'd like to do some paired comparisons of humans and mice with targeted deletions of some key genes. And then in the third part of the talk, I'll present some data, including some unpublished work from our group, using neuropeptide probes in the human to further understand GnRH modulation. So that's sort of what I hope to accomplish in the next 45 minutes. Oh. Dan, you deal with it. Okay, so I'm just going to press. Okay, so we're going to start with a patient. This is a patient who presented in 1943 to Fuller Albright at Mass General Hospital. He's really considered one of the fathers of modern endocrinology in the last 100 years. And this is a patient who was a young man, had good general health, but as you can see, was not well masculinized and had clearly small genitalia, looked like he hadn't gone through pubertal development. His physical examination gave some clues that this was an early, perhaps congenital process, in that he was not only short, but he had unicoid proportions, meaning his arm span was longer than his height. He had no axillary or pubic hair, small phallus, small testes. In fact, one testicle was really atrophic. And so this patient has, as Dan said, hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, a mouthful to say, but let's just review the basic physiology. We all appreciate that in a normal individual, GnRH is secreted in a pulsatile fashion, and it's that pulsatile program of secretion which is necessary for appropriate gonadotropin release from the pituitary with LH and FSH, and then appropriate gonadal stimulation leading to folliculogenesis, spermatogenesis, and secretion of the sex steroids. In patients with hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, there is an abnormality in the secretory program of GnRH such that you fail to get that pituitary stimulation and, by extension, gonadal stimulation. That abnormality in GnRH secretion can be either that GnRH is not synthesized, or if it's synthesized, thank you so much, it's not secreted in an appropriate fashion. So there can be multiple etiologies for how someone becomes hypogonadotropic. But in any event, the type of pattern that you see in patients' gonadotropins is really an absence of LH pulsatility. We know that in general, there's a fairly good concordance between GnRH release and LH pulses. And so the textbook patient with GnRH deficiency has a neuroendocrine pulse pattern that looks like this. There is an absence of endogenous LH pulsations coming from the pituitary gland. However, several years ago, the head of our unit in Boston, Dr. William Crowley, demonstrated that you could treat patients with GnRH deficiency by using an exogenous, portable, programmable infusion pump, and that by administering this pump to patients, you could awaken the pituitary gland, set in place LH pulsatility, and then recapitulate all of the normal changes of human puberty. So in the patient that we just saw in the preceding slide, you could basically induce testicular maturation and spermatogenesis. In a female patient who maybe has never had a spontaneous menstrual period, you could induce ovulation and fertility in a matter of weeks. So this was a very powerful and physiologic therapy. At almost the same time in his career, Dr. Crowley also demonstrated that you could administer long-acting analogs of GnRH, and after an initial rise in LH, you could undergo a paradoxical desensitization at the level of the GnRH receptor. This biologic concept is now pharmacologically used every day in standard reproductive care with drugs like Lupron, in which you need a reversible medical castration for the patient to shut down sex steroid synthesis. So right away in the early 1980s, these concepts of stimulation and suppression of the reproductive cascade with G and RH at the pivot point were in our field. Now, if you hear about the condition of GnRH deficiency, it is admittedly a relatively rare condition. I've put here on the slide, under the most severe sort of phenotypic spectrum, that these patients almost represent like a Peter Pan syndrome if left untreated. They're sort of imprisoned in their own sexual immaturity unless they undergo therapy, which fortunately most do. But if you look along this axis, there really are a variety of disorders, both common and rare, which touch on this issue of modulation of GnRH release. So, for example, on the left-hand part of the slide, we have women, a woman here with hypothalamic amenorrhea. This is a condition in which somebody goes through normal pubertal development, but perhaps is an excessive exerciser or has an eating disorder, and therefore has an acquired shutdown of the reproductive cascade. Here in the middle are individuals with constitutional delay of puberty, so adolescents who are a little late going through their pubertal program, but eventually spontaneously kick into pubertal development by age 18. We also have some patients here in between constitutional delay and severe GnRH deficiency who have what we call reversal. That is, they look like a typical congenital patient with hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, but surprisingly, in their adult life, for whatever reason, the GnRH neurons wake up, begin firing, and the patient no longer needs hormonal medication. So there is a clear spectrum here of severity, and we believe that if we understand the genes that cause this disease using a very severe disease model, we can inform the genetics and biology of some very common disorders that we see in reproductive clinics all the time. So I've just taken you through what I call sort of the endocrine functions of the GnRH neuron, a clinical spectrum here from hypothalamic amenorrhea to GnRH deficiency. And there are a handful of genes which have been identified in the last 10 years that really speak to that function of the GnRH neuron, secrete GnRH. There are, however, patients with GnRH deficiency or hypogonadotropic hypogonadism who carry mutations in another handful of genes that speak to the more developmental program of GnRH development. These patients often have anosmia or an inability to smell because they have disordered GnRH neuronal migration from the olfactory placode. They may also have other anomalies such as renal agenesis, synkinesia, which are mirror movements of the extremities, and cleft lip and palate. And while these make sort of an easy categorization of genes, those genes for endocrine function and genes for the developmental ontogeny of GnRH neurons, it's important to remember that the more we study the genetics, the more we see some interplay and crosstalk between these pathways. So, for example, you may see an anosmic patient who has a mutation in one of these more endocrine-related genes. So these aren't perfect divisions, but I think for the purposes of today's talk, they're helpful. Okay, so as Dan mentioned, back in 2003, our group in Boston and a group led by Nicolas Deroux in France discovered that mutations in a then little-known G-protein-coupled receptor, the kisspeptin receptor, were a cause of hypogonadotropic hypogonadism in both humans and in mice. And a few years later, our colleague Ursula Kaiser at the Brigham, working in collaboration with Ana Claudia Latronico from Brazil, identified a gain-of-function mutation in a young girl with central precocious pubertal development. So in the space of a few years, suddenly loss of function and gain of function mutations in absent pubertal development or precocious pubertal development put the kisspeptin pathway on the map as a key regulator of the reproductive cascade. So what is kisspeptin, the ligand for the receptor? Well, it starts as a parent protein. It's a 145 amino acid protein that gets proteolytically processed to its mature form, the 54-mer. There are other shorter forms that have been identified in human samples. And we believe that the C-terminal part of this protein is really where the biologic activity resides. Kisspeptin is expressed in the brain in multiple regions of the hypothalamus in rodent models. It's expressed in the arcuate nucleus and the AVPV, or anteroventral periventricular nucleus, as well. In other species that don't have an AVPV, KIS expression is largely localized to the arc, or in higher species, the infundibular nucleus. And there were two articles in succession by Jeremy Smith that put into play the possibility that kisspeptin might be a key modulator of sex steroid modulation and regulation of the central reproductive axis. Here on the top part of the slide, Jeremy's showing by in situ hybridization that expression of kisspeptin in a castrate animal in the arcuate nucleus goes up dramatically, and if you replace the animal with testosterone, kisspeptin expression drops. And this set up the hypothesis that in the arcuate nucleus in the rodent, kisspeptin modulates negative feedback for sex steroids. At the same time, in the AVPV, if you castrate a male animal, kisspeptin expression drops. And if you sex steroid replace, kisspeptin expression now goes up, establishing the hypothesis that kisspeptin modulates positive feedback in this particular nucleus in the AVPV, which would be particularly relevant in female animals for the mid-cycle surge. So negative feedback in the ARC, positive feedback in the AVPV. And the rodent, because it has this anatomic compartmentalization with these two regions, has really been the focus of intense studies to determine exactly what the function is of the ARC and the AVPV for kisspeptin modulation. And it's an area of intense investigation and continued controversy up until today. But it's important to note that kisspeptin expression does rise during the time of sexual maturation. That's been shown in several rodent models, as well as in the non-human primate. And this is data from both Tony Plant and Sergio Ojeda's laboratories demonstrating increases in KIS, and in some cases the KIS receptor, across sexual maturation in the monkey. So what does kisspeptin do physiologically? This is work that we did in collaboration with Robert Steiner's laboratory, where we simply gave an injection of kisspeptin to an adult male animal. You can see LH rises significantly. And if you pre-treat the animal with a GnRH antagonist, acylin, you completely abrogate this kisspeptin-induced rise, suggesting that kisspeptin increases LH through hypothalamic actions and through working at the GnRH receptor. In other words, kisspeptin is talking to the GnRH neurons. It's not directly talking to the pituitary gonadotrophs. Now, in 2008, another player joined the scene. There was a powerful article in Nature Genetics by Topologlu and Semple and their collaborators, in which mutations in another neuropeptide called neurokinin B were also identified in patients with hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. In one paper, mutations in both ligand and receptor were identified, and right away this discovery created a stir because it had recently been demonstrated that kisspeptin and neurokinin B were actually co-expressed in certain populations of the hypothalamus. And this is work from Bob Goodman's group showing co-localization of kisspeptin and neurokinin B, as well as kisspeptin and dynorphin. And as Dan was saying yesterday, this has led to sort of the cute little name for this neuronal population as the candy neuron, K-N-D-Y, representing the co-expression of these three neuropeptides. Whereas kisspeptin, if you give it to a mouse, a rat, a sheep, a goat, a monkey, and in many cases a human, is a powerful secretag for GnRH release, neurokinin's biology has been a little bit more complicated to figure out. So here on the bottom part of the slide, I've demonstrated three different experiments in three different papers, and there are many to echo this theme, in which the administration of a neurokinin B receptor agonist either inhibits LH, does nothing to LH, or stimulates LH. And it has been very confusing in the literature to really figure out what the actions of neurokinin B are. It was assumed that if loss-of-function mutations were identified in patients with no pubertal development or hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, then at baseline, neurokinin B must be in some way stimulatory to the reproductive cascade. But that's been more difficult to show physiologically. And I think collectively our community is realizing that there's much more exquisite sensitivity to the sex steroid milieu for neurokinin B's actions than there is for kisspeptin. The Steiner Laboratory, compiling expression data, put in place a hypothesis of how these three neuropeptides could be working in concert. And this is a hypothesis which is being actively explored. If you have all three of these neuropeptides in a single neuron, KIS, NKB, and dynorphin, it is important to note that NKB receptors sit themselves on these candy cell bodies. So is it possible that neurokinin B provides some self-amplification signal that allows kisspeptin to be released in a stimulatory fashion, and kisspeptin goes to talk to the GnRH neurons, and dynorphin, working on a separate neuronal population, provides some type of inhibitory signal, perhaps sculpting the kisspeptin and, by extension, GnRH pulse in some physiologic manner. This is a model that's out there and being actively explored. Well, now you've got kisspeptin and NKB. Where does the community sit on their relative importance and relative value? This is work by Tony Plant's group, in which a continuous kisspeptin infusion was given to agonadal male monkeys. Continuous kisspeptin in the monkey model, just like a GnRH analog in the human, desensitizes its receptor. So if you give kisspeptin here, you essentially take out kisspeptin receptor signaling. And if you look here in the black dots, the administration of senctide, shown here in the S, which is a neurokinin B receptor agonist, has no effect or minimal effect in an animal undergoing a KIS infusion. Note that in the absence of an infusion, shown in the white circles, senctide, at least in this monkey model, is quite stimulatory. And that sets in place a cascade that now begins to look like this. KIS and NKB sitting above GnRH physiologically, maybe NKB sitting above KIS in some sort of amplified or amplification signal, but then the kisspeptin signal coming down, stimulating GnRH, and then the gonadotropins, and then the sex steroids. So there's an intertwined and increasingly complex biology of kisspeptin and neurokinin B. Both pathways are implicated as genetic causes of GnRH deficiency. Both neuropeptide ligands are co-expressed in the same neurons of the hypothalamus, and both stimulate GnRH-induced gonadotropins, but to different degrees, and that's particularly true for NKB. Okay, now let's start to interweave some human genetics. If you look at these peptides, you've got GnRH, kisspeptin, and neurokinin B. And at the level of the human phenotype, do we see the same degree of severity of mutations in patients when they have an abnormality in any one of these signaling pathways? In other words, what's the trunk of the tree and what's an external branch when it comes to severity? So let's start with the GnRH gene itself. You and I might think that that's really the most obvious candidate gene for a GnRH deficient patient, but it actually took us as a community several years before we identified a few rare individuals who contained mutations in this gene. So here's an example of a male individual. He carries biallelic mutations in the gene encoding GnRH1. He makes no GnRH. And if you look at his clinical phenotype, it's quite severe. He has cryptorchidism or undescended testes, small phallus, and this patient actually underwent a testicular biopsy as a young person in which he had immature seminiferous tubules, immature Sertoli cells, and just gonocyte-like cells. So very severe androgen deficiency. Similarly, there have been patients carrying biallelic mutations in the GnRH receptor. Here's one mutation, although it's a missense mutation by nature. In vitro, there was a complete loss of second messenger signaling from this receptor. And again, if you look at the phenotype of the family that carries mutations in this receptor, the gonadotropins are markedly diminished, the patient is unicoidal, no evidence of masculinization, and undescended testes. There are mouse models for deletion of both the GnRH gene and modification of the GnRH receptor gene. This is well known to many members of the audience, the HPG mouse, which is actually a naturally occurring mouse in which there's partial deletion of the GnRH1 gene. And in echoing the human phenotype, you see complete failure of postnatal gonadal development in this animal. Now let's move to kisspeptin. This is an individual from a family who carries a homozygous change in the kisspeptin 1 gene. Again, in vitro studies, this change brings about a markedly abnormal peptide with very little signaling. And if you look at the pulse pattern in an affected individual, instead of having nice, brisk LH pulses like the healthy sister, the affected individual here has a complete absence of LH pulsations. But now let's look at someone carrying a mutation in the GnRH receptor, in the kisspeptin receptor. As I showed you earlier, kisspeptin mutations have been identified in patients with GnRH deficiency. Initial studies in the mouse demonstrated by our group and a group in the United Kingdom that the mouse was a fairly faithful phenocopy to the human condition. But when we looked more closely at our human patients, we saw something unusual. And this is the study of an individual who carries compound heterozygote severe mutations in KIS1R. Here's a normal male LH pulse pattern for comparison, brisk LH pulses, and here's our patient's pulse pattern. Now note that on the y-axis here, we've amplified that up because otherwise this baseline would appear just almost completely flat. So we've magnified the y-axis up. And these blue arrows indicate very small LH pulses. So they meet our pulse algorithm, but they're very, very small in amplitude and certainly nowhere close to the robust pulses you would see in a normal volunteer. But this patient also underwent what we call a dose-response study to exogenous GnRH, meaning he came to our research center and received 5 doses of GnRH IV, and we plotted his LH response. And you can literally make a linear dose response curve in a human patient of their LH responsiveness to GnRH therapy. Most patients look like this. This dotted line represents a handful of patients without kisspeptin receptor mutations. Our patient is leftward shifted. He's actually more sensitive to exogenous GnRH compared to other individuals. So he has this sort of wandering baseline, sort of an enfeebled GnRH program, and he's actually quite sensitive to exogenous GnRH when it's administered, suggesting to us that despite these very severe mutations in the kisspeptin receptor, maybe there's still some leakiness in his axis or some compensatory mechanisms that are trying to push through reproductive signaling. So we went back to look at our mice. And one of the members of our team, Ming Chan, who was phenotyping these animals, noticed that although these animals had delayed sexual maturation and were infertile, the animals had changes in their estrus cyclicity over time. They would toggle back and forth between estrus and diestrus, estrus and diestrus. They never ovulated, they were never fertile, but there seemed to be some changes in their sex steroid milieu based on the smears. And in a series of very careful experiments, Ming was able to demonstrate that the gonadotropin secretion in mice, while it is predominantly kisspeptin dependent, there is a quantifiable and reproducible element of gonadotropin secretion that is kisspeptin independent. So our human data and our mouse data began to put some brackets around kisspeptin. That as powerful as this neuropeptide was, and believe me, we helped to put it on the map, we were on the kisspeptin train, but it was bracketed in its physiologic relevance, perhaps by redundancy, compensation, or the need for the reproductive axis in the setting of very deleterious mutations to find other plasticities or workarounds to keep reproduction going. Now let's go to neurokinin B mutation patients. This is a patient who carries a homozygous mutation in the ligand neurokinin B. Again, it's biallelic, it's a frame shift, so it's severe. She makes absolutely no neurokinin B protein. Although she carried a diagnosis of GnRH deficiency, shortly after she was married, she conceived a patient without any fertility medications. And her son is now, I think, about 11 years old. So how can that be? You have GnRH deficiency, no stimulation of the pituitary, no gonadotropin release. You're told that you're infertile unless you take specific fertility medications. And yet somehow you spontaneously ovulate, and not only ovulate, you conceive. This is not the only time we've heard this story. This is a patient, for example, who has biallelic missense mutations in the neurokinin B receptor. Again, they're severe. There's no second messenger signaling in a heterologous cell line in which this mutation was tested. And yet when this patient comes in, on initial assessment, he's markedly hypogonadal. He's a textbook GnRH deficient patient with a testosterone of only 65 nanograms per deciliter. Normal range is 300 to 1,000. And yet, after taking a break from testosterone treatment, his testosterone now is 222, and he's got some beautiful LH pulses here. He has turned on his reproductive cascade, as did the female patient in the previous slide. And this is a phenomenon known as reversal of GnRH deficiency. It's been reported at the case report level through the 1980s, but colleagues of mine in the reproductive endocrine unit in the late, about 5 or 6 years ago, really quantified how frequently this happens in GnRH deficient patients. And they found that about 10% of patients spontaneously recover GnRH function. What triggers that still remains a mystery. And indeed, when we look at mice that are knocked out for the neurokinin receptor, although they were first reported in the literature to be fertile and not to have a reproductive phenotype, we now appreciate that these animals do have abnormalities in estrous cyclicity. They have some limited fertility, but reduced ovulatory events and reduced numbers of corpora lutea. And we're currently in the process now of phenotyping our TAC ligand deficient animals. And so the mouse and the human, while not perfectly, do appear to mirror each other in that their phenotypes are less severe. So here you have GnRH. It's the trunk of the tree. Both mice and humans have complete hypogonadotropism. Kisspeptin-deficient animals and humans have a severe phenotype, but there are glimmers of kisspeptin-independent GnRH secretion. And neurokinin, the receptor or ligand-deficient mice and humans, have a less severe phenotype in which there are suggestions for stronger compensation through that pathway. Okay. So in the final few minutes of the talk, I want to focus in the human model of how we have tried to use kisspeptin as a way to probe GnRH neuronal integrity. If you think about it, for 30-plus years, we've had GnRH as a way to probe the pituitary gland. And as I mentioned in our unit, for about 30 years, we treated patients with GnRH deficiency wearing this pump. We would dial up the frequency or dial it down, dial up the dose or dial it down. And we could explore all sorts of aspects of negative feedback loops and gonadotrope biology in a human model. But we've never had a probe to talk to the GnRH neurons themselves, which is where certainly in 95% of patients the seat of this disease lies. And so the discovery of kisspeptin really gave us an opportunity to talk to human GnRH neurons. So we started to build a human program in kisspeptin administration. I caution you, however, that when you see some of the data on these slides, we can't measure GnRH in real time in humans. As you know, it's a small peptide. It's sort of restrained to the hypophyseal portal circulation. It's very difficult to assay. So because we can't measure GnRH, we continue to use LH as our surrogate marker of GnRH secretion. But when you see that LH, you have to remember that our team isn't asking questions about LH. We're using LH as a marker to ask questions about GnRH neuronal biology. Okay, so I'd first like to acknowledge the work of colleagues in the United Kingdom who were really the first to administer kisspeptin in the human. This is work by Waljit Dillo and Steve Bloom, and Waljit's taken this further in several other publications. They were the first to give kisspeptin to healthy male volunteers. This data shows the results of giving a brief 90-minute infusion of kisspeptin. And as you can see in the red squares, compared to vehicle-treated healthy subjects, LH brings about, as we might expect, a very robust LH. I'm sorry, kisspeptin brings about a very robust LH response, and for FSH, a more modest response. So at the first blush, kisspeptin looks, in a male subject, just like what it looks like in a mouse, a rat, a goat, and a monkey. So we started our program with kisspeptin administration. And here, just for comparison, is a healthy subject, normal LH pulsations. Here we come with a shot of kisspeptin in the middle of this intensive blood sampling study. Remember, when we're up on our clinical research center, we have no real-time assessments of LH. We don't know whether when we're injecting a patient, they're at a peak of a pulse, at the nadir of a pulse, because we're blind to their endogenous pulse generator. But here at the yellow arrow, they get a shot of kisspeptin, and there's a very nice LH response. And in another subject who was already on the upswing of an endogenous LH response and just beginning to come down, we come up with an injection of KISS, and that overrides it. Again, LH goes up. So if we take all of our male volunteers and temporally align them to the point of kisspeptin administration, all of their endogenous pulsatility sort of evens out to a flat baseline. And you see the cumulative effect over 13 healthy male subjects of kisspeptin administration. You see that kisspeptin induces a single pulse, and it elevates GnRH-induced LH secretion for approximately 4 hours. That's the time point at which it's necessary then for LH to return to baseline. And the size of this pulse is a little bit bigger in amplitude and a touch bigger in area under the curve compared to endogenous pulses, but it's not tremendously far off. To demonstrate the fact that the dose that we're giving of kisspeptin in these studies is fairly physiologic. We're not overwhelming the system with some massive LH release. We're sort of in the right ballpark. At least this is relatively comparable to endogenous pulsatility in shape and morphology. By doing a complex series of calculations, we were able to determine that when we give a single injection of kisspeptin to a healthy male, we are stimulating a GnRH secretory event of 17 minutes in duration in the human brain. And that has remarkable fidelity to animal models in which if you sprinkle kisspeptin on some GnRH neurons in culture, you get electrophysiologic stimulation for 16 minutes in duration. So despite the complexity of the human model, there can be some remarkable fidelities in biology. So here on this slide, in this top panel, I've re-summarized the male data. This is a representative male subject receiving a single injection of KISS, and here's the composite data when all 13 men are aligned to the point of administration. Now let's look at healthy women. We see the same thing, a representative subject and the composite data for 14 women in the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle. We see a brisk LH response that, again, looks grossly similar to that of the male response in terms of morphology. Here are women in the periovulatory phase of the cycle. So remember, we have the positive effect of estradiol in terms of amplifying the pituitary signal. So note here that on the y-axis, we've amplified that up now eightfold. But again, you see a clear response to kisspeptin, and in our composite data, a very robust response. But in this final panel, we have complete discordance when we look in the follicular phase. So this is a representative subject in the early follicular phase of the menstrual cycle. She receives an injection of kisspeptin, the same dose we've been doing for all these studies at the Arrow, and there's no response at all. If you align the composite data, if you squint, you see a small response to KISS. About 50% of women in the early follicular phase did have a response to KISS, but the LH response was extremely modest, and that's very obvious here. This is in no way comparable to this or this. So men respond. Women in the luteal phase respond. Women in the periovulatory phase respond very briskly. But women in the follicular phase really don't respond at all. And we've gone up on the dose. Our colleagues in the United Kingdom have seen this observation as well. Why do women in the follicular phase not respond to kisspeptin? And is that telling us that there's some difference in the ambient kisspeptin tone? Could there be so much kisspeptin in the follicular phase that our little drop in the bucket injection evinces no response at all? Or is there completely different regulation of the reproductive cascade in the follicular phase in a woman compared to the other phases of the cycle? So this is a great curiosity to us and one that we're exploring. So in the last few slides, I want to show you one of our great hypotheses that's been difficult for us to study. We study not only healthy volunteers, but patients with GnRH deficiency. And we spent our time at the beginning of the talk this morning outlining genes that cause that disease. And I explained to you that there were a handful of genes that were endocrine related and a handful that were more developmentally related. And we struggle as a community, even though we've identified these mutations, to still understand the biology of these proteins. How do they truly affect GnRH neuronal migration or GnRH function? We thought with kisspeptin we'd found a great probe to answer this question. And we hypothesized, for example, that we could take a patient with a mutation, give them a shot of kisspeptin, and compare their response to, let's say, a healthy volunteer. Maybe their response would be 50% as strong as a healthy volunteer, and maybe we would sort of extrapolate, well, maybe they have 50% of their neuronal complement. So we were hoping to use this as a quantitative tool. We have struggled with this. This is a patient carrying mutations in one of those developmental genes, FGFR1, fibroblast growth factor receptor 1. Okay, it's one of those developmental genes. And we did a similar protocol in our deficient patients as with our healthy volunteers. We give a shot of kisspeptin, and then we gave a shot of GnRH at the end. So in this GnRH deficient patient, as you can see, he's got no LH pulses. He barely responds to GnRH. And he certainly does not respond to kisspeptin. There's no response. We then take this patient and we have him wear one of those GnRH pumps for a week. Because remember, a GnRH deficient patient who's not stimulating their pituitary gland, who's maybe just using topical gel testosterone for 10 years, their pituitary gland's asleep. It hasn't had to do any work for a decade. So we wake up that pituitary gland by giving the patient GnRH for 7 days. So we can be sure that if we have a negative response to kisspeptin, it's not because the pituitary was sleeping. It's because the patient's GnRH neurons truly did not respond. So we give this patient the pump. We come back for a second study. You can see that priming worked. You now give GnRH. That pituitary is ready, awake, and responding. But there is no response to kisspeptin in this individual. And this is the same dose we gave to our healthy men and our healthy women. So we know what it should do in a healthy individual. And it does nothing to this patient. All right, we'll try another patient. This person has two mutations, an FGFR1 and now a kisspeptin ligand mutation. Again, sort of a similar study in that there's no intrinsic pulsatility. This patient actually has a little bit more of a robust response to GnRH, however. We call this patient almost endogenously primed. Something's leaking through because the pituitary mounts a better response here. It's not completely asleep, but there's no response to KISS. We still make the patient wear the GnRH pump. We come back in with kisspeptin. No response to kisspeptin. Okay, try somebody else. This is a female patient. She's got mutations, again, in FGFR1. She comes in, a more measurable LH baseline, no pulses. She's very clearly endogenously primed, very robust GnRH response. She still wears the pump. She comes back in, same story. No response to KISS. We started to get so frustrated, we said, well, maybe we've got to wake up the hypothalamus. We always talk about pituitary priming. Maybe you need hypothalamic priming. So we've gave that female patient multiple single boluses of kisspeptin. No response. And we've done the same in another one of our male patients, successively increasing doses. No response. Now, lest you think nobody responds to kisspeptin, one of our colleagues in the UK has given a continuous infusion in a human. This is a normal male volunteer. You can see LH goes from about 4 to about 40 during the infusion, so a brisk response in a healthy male. They then gave that infusion to somebody with neurokinin pathway mutations. Remember, neurokinin might sit slightly above kisspeptin and then GnRH, gonadotrophs, and organ. And so at baseline, you have the blue. Person has very little pulses. They get this kisspeptin infusion. Now they're in the black with these little starred blips. So the authors of this paper felt by giving the infusion, they increased pulsatility in this GnRH-deficient patient. And there are more blips than there is in the blue. But the amplitudes and the magnitude, you're going from 0.2 in this particular LH assay to 0.4 at a mean level. It's very modest. You're not doing a tenfold increment that you do in a normal male. So we don't know. In contrast to healthy men and luteal phase and periovulatory women, single bolus administration of kisspeptin in a congenital GnRH deficient patient really appears to have no release effect on LH. And we see this across genotypes, across the two sexes, and across multiple boluses. And we're now testing different sex steroid environments. Is there relative kisspeptin resistance, even though I don't like to use that word, in the hypogonadotropic state? We don't know. But is there something about not having activation of this cascade which changes the fundamental circuitry surrounding kisspeptin and GnRH neurons that's too difficult for us to overcome in the models that we're using? So I'm going to stop there in terms of our data. I want to acknowledge all of my colleagues back in the reproductive endocrine unit, my laboratory team, our collaborators really from around the world, and most importantly, our referring physicians and our patients who so generously give of their time to participate in these very detailed phenotyping studies and to send us DNA samples from around the world so we can try to understand this disease's genetic architecture. So thank you so much for your attention. I'd be happy to take any questions.
As you get ready to ask your questions, oh, thanks, Simon. I would just, for all of the speakers, when you're asking a question, please go to one of the two microphones. Please state your name and then ask your question. Thanks.
Yes, hello.
Thank you. So just in terms of amenorrhea, like due to exercise, weight loss, is that acting at kisspeptin and neurokinin B, or do we have to...
Right, great question. We'd all love to know the answer to that. There is work by the group in London, at least on kisspeptin administration in subgroups of patients who have hypothalamic amenorrhea. Now, one of the challenges, there's only three groups in the world so far, us in Boston, the group in London, and the group in Scotland, that are giving exogenous KIS. But the challenge is we're doing it all a little bit differently, which is why I didn't put their HA data into this talk. They're using the longer form of kisspeptin, the 50-former, whereas our group in Boston and the Scottish group use the 10-mer. And in women, they're administering it subcutaneously, where of all of the studies I've shown you are IV. So in a woman getting a longer formulation and maybe more of a depot-type administration with sub-Q, it looks as if there had been some stimulatory effects in HA, but that may go away over time. So there may be some sort of depot release, different formulation that abrogates the response on repetitive administration. But they now have, if you're interested in the details, I think two publications in that subgroup. Is KIS mediating the suppression that you see in HA? Don't know. There's been a lot of talk about, could KISS be the link between energy and reproduction? Leptin receptors sit on KISS pepton neurons. Is that the link? Are they talking to KISS candy neurons? And there have been beautiful genetic studies, most recently by Carol Elias, in which she's done selective leptin receptor knockout signaling on KISS pepton neurons and has not seen effects. So leptin may be talking to KISS neurons, but it doesn't appear to be directly so. So that's another very hot area of investigation, I think, several groups are working on.
Yes. My name's Bruce. I was going to ask you about leptin, but you already answered my question.
I'm sorry.
Well, I have another one. I always have another one. I just got back from Chile, and they have an interesting model in a llama where LH is induced by intramuscular or intrauterine infusion of nerve growth factor. And I wonder if you know of any associations between nerve growth factor and this whole complex of GnRH activating system in the hypothalamus.
You know, that's a great question. Has not gotten a lot of attention. I think when the KISS pepton receptor was first being described and cloned, there were homologies to somatostatin receptors. We actually know that the KISS receptor is highly expressed in the pituitary, but it really hasn't been well characterized in what cells that occurs. Is it just the gonadotrophs? I don't think so. There may be other pituitary lines. So that's an interesting potential connection. I don't know that it's been really formally explored.
Well, it's a good model for it.
Yeah.
I guess I'll take the moderator's
prerogative.
Prerogative, that's the word, yeah. I have a couple of questions. The first one had to do with the GPR54 knockout mice, where you showed that at least in some of them there was still some pituitary function. Mm-hmm. You showed FSH there, and if I saw it clearly, when those animals were treated with a GnRH receptor antagonist, you actually didn't have an effect on FSH secretion. So that actually suggests that something else is stimulating FSH in those animals, probably activin. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you're... if you can conclude that there's still GnRH activity in those GPR54 mice, or if it's something else that's acting independently of GnRH.
Yeah, we don't know. At the time that we were doing those studies, it was just heralding the discovery of neurokinin B. And so we were thinking, are there other genetic modulators that could potentially be in place? And one of our goals in terms of figuring out whether neurokinin, because neurokinin receptors have been reported by Naomi Rantz to exist on GnRH neurons, not just on their own cell bodies on candy neurons. And apparently, I was talking to Naomi recently because some people, I think, have doubted the verity of that finding, but she had told me personally that the antibodies had changed, and she still sticks by the fact that there are NKB receptors on GnRH neurons. So we were interested in whether, again, in severe mutations where the KISS pepton system's been taken out of place, that neurokinin B could try to come in and stimulate a GnRH signal. And in our human program, what we are trying to do is match individuals who by themselves are endogenous knockouts for KISS pepton, and we then want to stimulate with NKB agonists, and people who are knockouts for the NKB signaling pathway and stimulate with KISS pepton. And so we're trying to use the human model. Doesn't always work out that perfectly, and some of these mutations are rare, or someone might live so far away they can't logistically come to you, but our goal is to try to use the human knockout situation to test those questions.
Last one. This is like, really picking me up. I probably can go to the back of the room. I was really interested in the data where you treated women with KISS pepton in the early follicular phase, and you didn't see an LH response. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, have you seen anything equivalent in any animal model? Because I wonder how you're actually going to get at what's happening there mechanistically. I mean, at the beginning of the follicular phase, arguably the pulse generator is sort of waking up again. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it begs the question of whether that awakening is KISS pepton dependent or not. And it might, if you had an antagonist, and I know those are in development, that would be a way that you could address that. But I don't know if you can you use the antagonist, if you had one, in a human, because presumably you would have to infuse this into the brain.
Yeah, well, so Dan's absolutely right. Our field has suffered because we do not yet have a good kisspeptin antagonist. There's so much biology that we'd like to attack by having that tool, and we just don't yet have one available. We are trying to use kisspeptin infusions as a pseudo-antagonist to at least take out the signaling pathway, even though it may not be a selective receptor antagonist. We're at least trying to be able to manipulate or take the kisspeptin signaling pathway out of the equation, and we're working on that actively. In terms of the follicular phase women, it's going to be a challenge, but one thing that we're thinking about is potentially modulating the sex steroid milieu of these women. We know from work in the monkey from A. Tarasawa's laboratory that there's definitely sex steroid responsiveness effects in animals as they go from being prepubertal to completing puberty. Their kisspeptin responsiveness increases. And so we're thinking, well, you get luteal phase women to respond, but you don't get follicular phase women. Is that a progesterone difference? Is it dependent on the difference in the milieu? So we're going to attack what we can easily in a human model and then wait for the other antagonist tools to be developed. It's hard, though. It took our team 5 years to go from submitting the initial protocols to give kisspeptin in the human to get human approval. So it's very difficult. I think to go through another 5 years for another human compound would be very tough for us, but we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
So please join me in thanking Stephanie for a great talk.